Thank you very much, Frank, and greetings to all of you. Special greetings to those on Cybercast around certainly North America, if not further than that, and we appreciate being able to do that in this wonder that God has given us and wonderful opportunity to serve at this great time in history. I grew up on the eastern slopes of the Canadian Rockies in a small coal mining town, and I've often taken teenagers, my wife and I actually together have taken 20 to 25 teenagers hiking into those mountains. One of the lessons I learned very early on in life, hiking in the mountains up there, is humility. You climb up those hills and struggle to get up them, and when you get to the top, you see another 100 or 200 hills, and you know you're never in a lifetime going to be able to climb them all. So it is a great lesson in humility. It's also a lesson in beauty, because when it's a clear, sunny day, you can see such gorgeous and wonderful sights. There's a stretch of mountains there with sheer cliffs on one side for almost 40 miles from Jasper National Park, and there was a statement made from the park commission that there's no way of getting out of the park in that 40-mile stretch. But two or three minister friends of mine and I one day went around halfway down through there, a place called Ruby Mountain, and we decided, looking at the slides, that the slope, that we actually could see one area, one saddle that we could be able to climb and get into the park itself. So we did that. We climbed that saddle and found out that, in fact, we could get into the park and come back out. And so the following year, we took 20 or 25 of our teenagers on that hike. Now, it ended up being a 20-mile hike to the base of that saddle or the mountain we had to climb, and then to get up the mountain. It was a very exciting adventure, and yet for some of the teenagers, it was a daunting and a frightening time. They carried pack sacks, and climbing a mountain when you're not used to it was very difficult. Not only that, one or two of them had last year's running shoes, and I remember one girl whose feet were so sore in her running shoes I had to cut the toe off to let her toes get through there properly. I carried moleskin for blisters and things like that for each one of them. And then climbing up that last stretch, especially to get to the top of this summit, this pass that we were going to get to, it was a time where you'd help each one, you'd help each other. And I was almost always the last one up because I would be helping the littler ones, the younger ones, to make it to the top of that hill. And I recall this one time that we went up there. And when you're climbing a mountain, of course, you see just in front of you. You're very myopic in vision. You don't see the mountains around you. You just see the hill you've got to climb, each step you've got to take, each detour you have to make. And it gets painful, and it gets sore, and you get tired, and you need to stop. And your brain starts telling you, what am I doing here? And why have I ever signed up for this? And I don't want to do this anymore. And so on. But I recall very clearly, once we did make it to the top with this group of teenagers, there were three girls, about 13 years old, who were, they were there already by the time I got there, because I was herding up the rest. But there were three girls that were sitting there, and they had their heads together, just sitting on their jackets, looking over and crying. They were weeping. And I thought to myself, I'm in trouble. One of them was a pastor's daughter. She's going to go home and tell her dad what a terrible man this Robert Barrett is, making us go up these mountains and climb over these terrible trails, and it's not fair, and my feet hurt, and I shouldn't have come, and why did Mom and Dad send me here? Maybe I thought, too, that one of them must have hurt themselves, you sprain your ankle or something like that could occur and happen. I'm sure they hated me for bringing them here with all these hardships, but there they were, these three girls, and they were sobbing on the top of this pass. Whenever I do get into the mountains, I think of what our Creator is like. He must love mountains. I think of Moses when he was 80 years old climbing up and down those mountains. But in the book of Matthew, there's a scripture which we should turn to, and if you are with me with the scriptures, or maybe up there, Matthew chapter 7. And it's an interesting statement that is made here for us. Matthew chapter 7, and in verse 11, first of all, it tells us that God knows how to give us good gifts. It says, if you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? So we know that. And so when God says to us, I want you to climb this mountain, I want you to get up this mountain, I want you to work hard, I want you to have some pain and some suffering, get up on this mountain because it's good for you. He goes on to tell us here in verse 13, you enter by the narrow gate. It isn't a broad highway that God puts us on to come into his family, into his kingdom. It's a narrow gate. He says, wide is the gate, broad and easy is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many that go in by that broad way. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life. And there are few who find it. Part of the reason is few people want to find something like that. But there are few who find it. It takes effort. It takes determination. There are a couple of other scriptures which are along this line, which help us see a little more clearly what God is saying in the book of Ecclesiastes. For example, in chapter 1, the writer of Ecclesiastes said, I set my heart to seek, this is verse 13, chapter 1 and verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task which God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. A burdensome task. And that's what life is. That's what God has given us for a very good and important reason. Go back a couple of pages to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 29. And there are other scriptures that refer to this similar type of a theme. Proverbs 29 and verse 18 says, where there is no vision or revelation, if we don't have a goal or objective, a clearly visualized place to go, where there is no revelation or vision, the people cast off restraint, but happy is he who keeps the law. And so it's important to have a goal in mind, even if it's a vague goal. When we took those teenagers for the first time through Jasper National Park for that 20-mile hike and then brought them to the base of this mountain they had to climb, this pass they had to climb, they had no idea what was on the other side. We did, because that's where we had scouted that out before. We knew what that was like, but they didn't. And we need a vision. You and I both need a vision. However vague it may be, we need a vision. And without that, we lose heart. We lose a sense of direction. The Bible does help us in this many, many ways. And one of the ways that we have is a story of Abraham. Abraham was a friend of God. He was a man who we respect and come to know, and God made promises to Abraham that go on and on. Let's turn back to the book of Hebrews and read some of these incredible statements that are written about this man. In chapter 11, we call that the faith chapter, and it's well named. Hebrews chapter 11, where there are men and women, faithful people of God, named here. Beginning in verse 8, it says, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. He didn't know what he was going to find, what he was going to see, but he trusted Almighty God. He trusted his Creator, who became his close friend. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob and heirs with him of the same promise. Because he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, Abraham doesn't know about that city, and God didn't tell him much about it. He glimpsed it somewhat. God didn't construct Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. This is a different city that Abraham was looking at. This is a different city that was yet to come. And Sarah was with him by faith. Sarah herself also received strength. And so we understand God works with his people in a very loving and a very caring manner and very caring way. Jumping ahead to verse 13, it does explain that all of these died in faith. Abraham, Sarah, and those who followed them. They have not received the promises. But they have seen them afar off and a distance. It's like coming to the base of a mountain and you're looking up and you see the summit, you see the top, you see the pass that you want to get into. And we would point that out to these teenagers. That's where we're going. That's the only way out of the park. As a matter of fact, in the way that park was established, once you made that hike to the halfway mark, the 20 mile mark, you couldn't go back. You had to go over that pass. Furthermore, it was against the law to park, or at least to camp overnight in the park, so we had no choice. We had to get over that pass to where the camp was. But in verse 13 it says, they died in faith, they have not received the promises, but they saw them. They, having seen them afar off, they were assured of them. So if you see the top, you see the glimpse, you're assured that it's there. And they embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in this earth. Wonderful lessons that we can learn from Abraham. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. They seek something different. They seek something greater, bigger than themselves, and bigger than anything you and I can begin to imagine, because there are things that God has in mind for us that we don't even have a vocabulary to put it into perspective in our minds. We don't have the words to describe it. John described what he saw before the throne of God like a sea of glass. That's the only words he had, a sea of glass. Helicopters or whatever he saw, he described as locusts. We work by what we have in our mind. But and truly in verse 15, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. It's like Lot's wife. She looked back to where she had come from. And we dare not do that if they recalled that. But they desire a better. This is what you and I are here for. This is what we're in God's church for. All of God's people around this world who have ever lived are here for this reason. They desire a better, that is a heavenly country. It's hard for us to comprehend some of these words. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Now we think of these concepts and we understand the magnitude and majesty that may be in there. Abraham was tested. He had a lot of climbing to do. He was tested in many ways as he traveled around. The greatest test of all was to be asked to sacrifice his son Isaac. But Abraham did not fail that test. He had that vision so clearly fixed in his mind. Jumping ahead to chapter 12 of the book of Hebrews, it says, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So each one of us has to learn to pace themselves. We have to learn to rest whenever we need to rest. We have to learn to help and assist one another as well and keep on going, because we're looking to verse 2. It says, to Jesus Christ, the author and the finisher of our faith. That's we are looking to whom we're looking. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So we need to remember the words of Jesus Christ at times. When he was climbing this particular big mountain that he had to climb, remember what he said to God sometimes. He said, Father, if it's possible, take this cup from me. That's what some of the teenagers said. Do we have to? Do we have to climb this mountain? If it's possible, take this cup from me. And when his load was too heavy, Simon the Cyrene came and helped him carry that load partly up that mountain. And then finally, even there was a moment in time where Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's a feeling we get. God had never left Christ, of course. He was there continually, all the time. But we feel that sometimes because we are so very, very human. A few verses down in verse 12, still of Hebrews chapter 12, God says then to you and to me, we have something to do. We could say to God, well, listen, give me big muscles, you know, give me the strength and I'll just fly up this mountain, give me a pair of wings or whatever. But he doesn't say that to us. He said, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. Well, we know we have feeble knees. You get halfway up a pass like that and you know it. You have to sit down a few times. And towards the top of that pass, when the air gets thin, you sit down about every 10 steps. They're carrying a pack sack. And it's a difficult climb, and it gets more difficult as you go. And make straight the paths for your feet. You make straight, he says. You be careful where you put your foot. You make straight the paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated. In other words, you don't sprain your ankle, but rather be healed. So there's a responsibility then that God gives to you and to me. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. So there's a requirement of us to work together. We had a policy climbing those mountains with those teenagers. We went as fast as the slowest person could walk. In other words, we all stayed together and helped each other. Look carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness spring up and trouble, and by this many become defiled. And you can get a little bit bitter, a little bit disgruntled sometimes when you're on these kind of hikes. If we jump ahead even a little bit further in there, in verse 22, an encouraging verse that Paul wrote here. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. We just sang about that. But you know, we sing these words about all these angels, and yet in our minds, We can't understand what that means, can we? Have you seen an angel? I mean, you know, a real angel. I see the description that Ezekiel gave. And I don't want to see that kind of an angel too close up, you know. Ezekiel had trouble describing that angel. But we've come, it says in verse 23, to the general assembly and the children of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. That's where your name is written if you're a converted, baptized member of God and following his family. To God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect. To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood of the sprinkling that speaks better of things than that of Abel. So there are incredible inspirational stories given to us here. In verse 26, it said, "His voice then shook the earth, but now he has promised, saying, 'Yet once more I shake not only the earth, but also heaven.'" Now, do we know what that means? We know that this earth of ours is temporary. It cannot continue circling around the sun forever and ever and ever. It just can't do it. The sun is burning out, and things will occur and happen. The earth finally, the sun loses gravity pull or whatever, and we can't exist. Something has to change. So God says he'll do it. Now, this, he says in verse 27, "Yet once more," this is Hebrews 12, "yet once more indicates the removal of the things that are being shaken as of things that are made, so that the things which cannot be shaken may remain." And then we ask ourselves, what does that mean? What cannot be shaken? And God doesn't tell us at this point, but there's got to be something which is eternal, which lasts forever and ever. It cannot be shaken. "And therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have the grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire." He's an incredible being. So we read these words, and of course it goes on to telling us here just in chapter 13 and verse 1, "Let brotherly love continue." And it's a wonderful thing to come together here and be with one another and see each other, even though maybe it's just once a year, and have that feeling of camaraderie and togetherness, like we know that we belong to each other. Don't forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Verse 5 in Hebrews 13, "Let your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have, for he has said," he himself has said, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." That means when you climb your mountain in life, as Abraham climbed his mountain in life, that God climbs with you, that Jesus Christ climbs with you. He promises that. "I'll never leave you. I will never forsake you." And he does actually mean that. So we may boldly say in verse 6 that the Lord is my helper. He'll carry my pack sack a little bit. He'll encourage me. He'll show me the way to go. He'll take me up there. I will not fear what man can do to me. These are very powerful words for us to take into our hearts and to live by. Verse 9 says, "Don't be carried about by various and strange doctrines." So we have to be on guard. We have to learn, appreciate God's way, his word. The Bible is his word and the only word. We live by that. "Don't be carried away by strange doctrines, for it is good that the heart be established by grace, not with the foods which have not profited those who have occupied by them." And jumping down to verse 12 of Hebrews 13. "And therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate." He climbed his mountain. "And therefore let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here, in this world, in this city, in this life, we have no continuing city. But we see the one to come. And therefore by him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name, but do not forget to do good, to share with such sacrifices God is well pleased." So we can have a back up a little and think a bit of what Abraham was looking at and what he was searching for, which he didn't see, but he thought about a great deal. He was looking for a city that didn't have walls, didn't have turrets and towers, and places where you could fight from. There was no Satan and no demons in his city. Human nature didn't exist there. There were no physical beings. This city that is referred to is about 1,500 miles high and wide, and we can't imagine that. If there was a city that size in this world, first of all, it would be outside the atmosphere of the earth, and it would wobble the earth around. We don't understand what God is going to do. We only glimpse it, just a little. A city that doesn't need the sun or moon, the Bible even says. It says it'll be a new heavens, and that's plural, and a new earth, transformed. Something has to be changed. There'll be a place where nobody will be proud and vain and ego-driven, and only the humble. Only the humble will be there, clothed with humility. So things have to change, and all of our hopes and dreams ought to focus on that future, on that city that Abraham was referring to. But we know that living in this life is the path that we walk on. This is the mountain that we climb, step by step, carrying our heavy pack sack, sitting down from time to time, helping one another as a strong help of the weak. This life is the stepping stone to that eternal kingdom. And how we walk in this life has everything to do with your place in the new order of things as that kingdom is established on this earth. I read through our booklet called The Gospel of the Kingdom, as you have it at home. And I was surprised in that booklet to find only a small paragraph. I'm sure we're going to write more on it because all of our literature is growing. You know, we've written some wonderful pieces of literature and we're continuing writing them. We're learning things. We've learned new knowledge, not in the sense of new, of changing doctrines, but we've learned deeper understanding of God's way, even this last year. And we've included things, for example, into the understanding of the Days of Unleavened Bread and the Passover season. But in that booklet, I was surprised to find only one sentence, and I'm sure we'll write more about it, one sentence in the booklet of the Gospel of the Kingdom about not the millennium or the time after that, but what's called in two words the eternal kingdom. Nothing more is written about it. It just says the eternal kingdom. And it says in that booklet, the millennium, a time of unparalleled peace and happiness and prosperity, will be just a foretaste of the even greater kingdom. And that's what I want to focus upon for all of you. The title of the sermon is Abraham's City. And I had trouble trying to figure out what to put down for a title, Abraham's City, but it is an even greater kingdom. Let's turn to the book of Revelation and, again, with this limited understanding we have, see what God does tell us about this in Revelation 21. Revelation 21 is a chapter which is written to us without giving us a detailed explanation, because we really wouldn't understand it. We have to just comprehend that the mind of God is so majestic, so much beyond ours, that our greatest thoughts, the highest thoughts we can have, don't even begin to come near his lowest thoughts, you might say. He just sees things in a far, far greater way. He's got this whole thing pictured out in his mind. He knows exactly what's at that summit that we're going to be coming to. He's taking us up to reach that high point. And so he tells us then here in Revelation 21, just a few points. In verse 1 of Revelation 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, a changed heaven and a changed earth, renewed in some form, in some way, in some fashion. And we often think in terms of a beautiful world, which is coming, where the deserts will bloom and the wolf and the lions lay down with the sheep and the cattle, and everything is wonderful. And children can play with with snakes, and it's all kinds of good fun. But that's not the whole picture. That's not the summit. That's not what God has in mind. There's much, much greater than that. So it says, we look at this first heaven and the first earth, they've passed away. They've changed and there's no more sea. There's big differences here. And I, John, trying to put this into words, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And again, we try to figure that out in words. And John is explaining to us just how we could explain it in his words without full understanding. I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them. They shall be his people. God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Now, if we read those words carefully and think about them just a little, if there is no more death, then there are no more animals, are there? Wolves or lions the way we would know them, because they die. Mosquitoes die. If they get near me, they die very quickly. You know? But there's no more death, he says. And so we should be looking for a time that goes beyond, even the millennium that we think about, a time that goes beyond that. And no sorrow. There could be sorrow. You could have somebody in your family that has fallen away from the truth, and you worry about them, you pray about them, and you wonder what the future is going to bring, and there are going to be people who you and I know who will be in the second death. There'll be a time of sorrow. But here's a time where there is no sorrow. We need to broaden our thinking. There's going to be a time where there isn't any sorrow and there's no crying. How do we get to that point? There shall be no more pain. Even animals feel pain. Animals give birth to a little one and they feel pain. Some of our men are out there in the fields, you know, bringing little cattle, little calves who are being born. And often the mother cow has a lot of trouble giving birth and they have to help her with it. It's a lot of pain in this world. And so we see the changes that are going to take place. No more death, no more sorrow, no more pain, no more crying. And David wept for Absalom, didn't he? Jesus Christ wept for Jerusalem. Can you just imagine when Christ came over the Mount of Olives and saw the city and broke into tears, knowing what that city is going to be facing in the next little while? How do you think that God felt at the time of Noah's flood? How do you think he's going to feel at the great tribulation that's going to come, where multiple millions of human beings will die of disease and sickness? So we've got to look further than what we do look sometimes and focus our mind. Verse 5, he said in Revelation 21, he who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. I make everything new, God says. And when you say everything, wow, that's an awful lot. He created the universe. He said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of water of life freely to him who thirsts. That's God's plan for mankind. So we need to look further than the millennium that we sing about, that we love to think about during the Feast of Tabernacles. We need to look beyond the Feast of Tabernacles. We need to look beyond the great white throne judgment. It's an interesting thought, and maybe you've wondered the same thing that I have, is why is it after the seventh holy day of the year, the great white throne judgment, there's a long span of time, over 5 months, before a new year begins and then they come to the first beginning again of the Passover? Why that big long span of time? Well, no other holy days in between. How about a future beyond that time? Well, God is fixing and working with us here and now. We're climbing these mountains that we're supposed to be climbing. So we need to look further ahead. We need to try to see what our Creator and our God and our Father and our brother, Jesus Christ, sees in the immediate future. There are many clouds in the sky for God at this time as well. Many clouds for us as well. We don't have a cloudless sky before us. There is still the mountain that you and I climb and all human beings ultimately climb. And God sees every cloud. But he also sees the view that's beyond the hill, you see, because God's the one who's come up the other side. He found that mountain pass. He knows exactly what's on the other side. He knows what we're going to see when we get on the other side as well. And that's why we read in Hebrews chapter 12 that Jesus Christ, for the joy that was set before him, endured the shame and the death that he endured for us. To me, that joy goes far beyond his resurrection. That was a time to be happy. He needed to be resurrected. Or that he'd intervene on our behalf. That's also a wonderful time to be happy. Or that he's going to return in the millennium and set things in order. That's also a thing to rejoice about. But his joy, in my mind, goes further than that. It goes to the city that Abraham was looking for. It goes to the plan of God, to that saddle. And what's going to be beyond that saddle? I don't think his joy stopped at the first resurrection or the beginning. And we need to look beyond today. We have a wonderful television program, Beyond Today. A long ways beyond today. We have to look that way. We have to look to the day when the dark clouds have disappeared and when we can see the clear blue skies with the uninterrupted glory and joy and peace. But now there are clouds in our sky. There's a mountain to climb. And you and I are going to get weary. We're going to be in need of hope. We're going to be in need of a dream, of a glimpse of this city that Abraham saw and thinks about. And the interesting thing is to know that is our father and our brother are also climbing their mountains. Almighty God is climbing his mountain. He's climbing just as we are through a time of great difficulty. He is carrying a heavy load. He's carrying a very heavy load, but he's looking forward to a day of joy beyond this mountain time. He's climbing with us, with you and with me. He's there to give us the strength we need, and it's not an easy climb for us, but it's not an easy climb for our Heavenly Father or his Son, Jesus Christ, either. Just think for a moment what the immediate future holds, the kind of clouds, you might say, are in God's realm and in his sky. Soon there'll be the terrible day of the Lord. suffering and agony, an untold scale, that so that if Jesus didn't return, he says no flesh would be saved alive. There's going to be a time where Satan and the demons are going to be bound and removed. And God loved Satan. Lucifer, when he created Lucifer and those angels, he loved them. It's going to hurt God to do these things to them. Nations of this world will not willingly come to God. They're going to fight him. There'll be the death of 5 men out of 6 of a 200 million man army. That's not a happy day for God. These are clouds that are still ahead. After the 1,000 years, can you imagine the unthinkable thing? After 1,000 years of peace and teaching on this earth, Satan's let loose and millions of people immediately follow him. That hurts God to have that happen, but it's going to happen. Those are clouds in his sky. And then comes the second resurrection, where God gives an opportunity to people who never had a chance. And then finally, the second death. These are all big clouds in God's eyes, in God's sky, the hills that he is going to climb. And what becomes obvious is that our Father in heaven and his Son, Jesus Christ, are suffering with us as we move forward. And Jesus Christ, of course, knew what we felt like because he became a human and suffered that way. So when you see that Jesus Christ wept when he looked at Jerusalem and considered her suffering, then we ask ourselves, what does he think now? It's a time of sorrow. Christ, when he's going to return back, is going to be as a glorious king, but he's also going to be as a conquering ruler with a rod of iron and flaming fire. A man by the name of C.S. Lewis was never converted, didn't understand what we understand, but he did glimpse something. He said, this life and what we experience and live in this life isn't the whole story. It isn't even the beginning of the story, but it's the title page. It's a starting page. It isn't the whole story. And it's a starting page that ultimately has to be erased. Because I do believe in some manner, all those who will be in the second death will be forgotten. Their names will be erased. Satan and the demons are going to be cast into outer darkness and no longer come to mind at all. All these clouds that I've talked about have to be removed. Finally then, when that occurs and happens, finally, it'll be the right time. The first page that God the Father, and only God the Father, and Jesus Christ his Son, know what's going to be in there and begin writing in that page. Now the true story of the future that Abraham was looking for, that you and I look for, can actually begin. Each chapter that's going to be written in that unwritten book is going to be better than the one that came before it. Each one is more beautiful and more successful for God's children. No clouds will ever occur again. It's going to be a time of unprecedented beauty. Let's go back to Romans chapter 8 for just a moment. Romans chapter 8 and beginning in verse 18. This is what Paul said as he glimpsed this picture, as he began to just get a little picture of what God has in mind, far greater than this present life. Yes, this life, we have to live this life correctly and properly in order to achieve that summit. You've got to climb that mountain. And I told these young teenagers that that's the only way to go. There's nothing down here for you. You've got to go back up there. And so, you know, slowly you get up and you're tired, you keep going. And Paul caught a glimpse of this mountain. Romans chapter 18, not the mountain, but the other side of it. Romans chapter 8 and beginning of verse 18. Paul said, I consider that the suffering of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. It's an amazing statement after what Paul went through. I mean, he climbed mountains that you and I haven't, hope we never ever have to climb, but he did climb his mountains. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Do you know that the God's plan for this universe is waiting for this moment for his children to reach that summit where the clouds will be clear, will be gone, the sky will be clear, and God's plan will finally hit and be in place. There'll be no more clouds, no more difficulties, nothing but the continuation of his plan. So the earnest expectation of the whole creation waits for this very moment. We're just dirt, aren't we? We're just dust. God made us that way, gave us a spirit and man, and we live. But we are to God the most important thing that's happening. Most important, more important than this universe, because that's what this universe is waiting for. The inheritance he promises is all of his creation. It's waiting for you, for the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, in the hope that you and I would climb this mountain, in hope that we'd catch the picture, the glimpse that Abraham got, and be God's friend, and be his children, be Christ's brother. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Hubble's telescope really shows us a universe that's got a lot of chaos there. Needs to be corrected and straightened. It's going to be made spectacularly beautiful as it's organized. We know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pains until now. Not only that, we also, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves, groan within ourselves. You groan. Climbing those mountains, those kids were groaning, I'll tell you. Carrying your pack sex up and didn't want to do it. Eagerly waiting for the adoption and the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what one sees? So we don't see. We only see the crest where God points the way. We walk with him and we don't see. And that's what it was like with these teenagers. We showed them where they had to go to climb up that mountain. And when I did see those three girls, back to those three girls I told you about, 13-year-old girls, they were not the big girls we had in the climb. They were the smallest ones, actually. One of them had the bad shoes and so on. I went over to those girls with a little bit of hesitation to say, why are you crying? What are you sobbing about? What did you hurt yourself? That's what I thought. Well, maybe they hurt themselves or something like that. And I came over to them and they said, Mr. Berndt, we have never seen anything as beautiful as this. You know, they sat in this crest of this pass, and from that point, you could see for 100 miles. You could see way past this town of Edson to the Crown Hills on the far side. 100 miles on a clear day, you could see such a beautiful, beautiful sight. They had never seen that before. That's why they were crying. They were weeping at the beauty that they had seen. And I think we're going to be like that when we become before the very throne of God. We're going to also be so amazed at what God has planned for us. So astonished at what his vision has been, his picture has been, this incredible future or city that he's got planned for us, that we're going to just be speechless. We don't have the words to describe it. We will be speechless in that time. A few years ago, I did see a movie, and sometimes you see a movie and words of that movie stick in your mind, kind of clear as songs and so on and so forth. I do like music as well. I enjoy it very much. And sometimes you hear a song or see something like that, which it really does stick in your mind. Just like the comment that C.S. Lewis made that this world or this life, you know, was the beginning, wasn't even the beginning, was a title page. The book hadn't yet been written. And only God knows how to write that book with your name in it and all the future that he's gotten in mind. But that particular piece of music was written by Alan Lerner, who I don't know, but he died some years ago. And it was sung by a few different artists in the meantime, but I had listened to a particular one sung by Barbara Streisand. And in the words of that, and sometimes again, you know, you just remember when this real story on this clear day is going to begin. The clouds are going to be gone, and the genius of God is going to be unleashed. All of the brilliance of God will be unleashed as planned, what he has planned for human beings, unhindered. Now his children, now his saints, no more physical beings, but all spirit beings, no evil thoughts, unhindered thoughts of God, no longer waiting for us to get ready. We will be ready. We will be his children. Far beyond the millennium, or the second resurrection, or the second death, far beyond that, we will reach that summit. And while we work and wait, we should look for that city while we climb our mountain. The words of that song, just a few of these words, it says, on a clear day. When you get up to the mountaintop and it's clear, as I said, you see for 100 miles. That's what those girls saw. And they couldn't describe it. They just started to cry. On a clear day, it says, you'll see who you are. And you know, climbing a hill like that builds character. Those young people, when they finished that climb, they were different. They had done something, accomplished something. You'll see who you are. You'll be a child of God. You'll be a spirit being in a position with responsibility. It will astound you, those words say. It will astound you on that clear day that your being will outshine every star. That's what God says in 1 Corinthians 13. Your being will outshine every star. You can hear from far and near a world you have never, never heard before. And on a clear day, that is to say, on that clear day, and this is the words of this song, on that clear day, you can see forever and ever and ever and ever more. God grant us and the ministry and the members of God's church alike this vision, the strength and determination to be there, to see that view with our Creator, our Father, and His Son.